of 1 Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians, in just a few moments, we'll be reading together from chapter 13. And so I'd like to start off by inviting us all to turn there together. Again, as has already been said, it is such a delight. It is such a pleasure to get to see so many of you this morning. So many of you that we have not been able to assemble with so far. You're here, and that is indeed a great blessing. I understand that, as our brother said, there is a time to refrain from embracing. And you may still feel as though that is this time. But I want you to know that I am viciously hugging you in my heart. You have metaphorical bruised ribs from the experience. Such is my fervor. I'm just glad to see you here. Again, it's just a joy and a pleasure to me for having missed so many of you over the past several weeks. Again, we're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, but I want to begin by telling you a story about a couple of family friends of ours. These were a couple of preachers, and they were riding together in the car. And there are some other things you need to know about them. One was sitting in the front seat, and one was sitting in the back. One spoke with a northern accent, the other with a southern accent, and they were both hard of hearing. And so the person in the front seat, this was just about the time when email was really starting to be active, and he posed the question to his brother in the back seat, "What do you think about this email evangelism? We've got a lot of email evangelists." Well, the brother in the back seat heard, "What do you think about all of these female evangelists?" And he said, "Well, I'm completely opposed to it." Well, the brother in the front seat was not expecting quite so zealous of a response, and he said, "Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that it might have its place. Maybe if it was done well, I don't really see anything wrong with it." Fortunately for these two men, one of them had their wife present, and she, after maybe a few moments longer than was necessary, said, "I don't think you two folks are having the same conversation." Now, to me, that's one of my favorite stories about those brethren. But it's only a funny story that I can tell because these people were friends who, in spite of that initial misunderstanding, eventually would have worked it out. And aside from that, if that failed, again, there was a good wife on the scene who was able to make sense of the situation. But I want you to consider for a moment how close those two men were to experiencing a situation that spiraled out of control, either because of miscommunication or a failure to communicate at all. Imagine, if you will, that they had not talked it out. And they had walked away from that, upset at each other, and they had gone and they had spread misinformation about the views of the other brother. You know, unfortunately, that's not terribly hard for us to imagine, because so often we have relationships that are either hindered or hurt because we fail to appreciate the importance of communication. Now, when I say that communication is important, I'm not speaking about the type of communication that we read about in self-help books or anything like that from a pop culture sense of the word. When we speak about communication, we're talking about that which is fundamental to the spread of the gospel. We're talking about something that is crucial to having unity and peace among a body of believers. You know, when it comes to telling other people about Jesus Christ, what could be more important than we develop the ability to helpfully communicate the gospel? And when it comes to preserving the peace and unity that we have with each other, what is more needed than that we cultivate a sense of being able to understand one another? Now, I've asked that you turn to the book of 1 Corinthians because I believe that the church at Corinth provides some valuable lessons on what makes for godly communication and, as a result, brings about better relationships. Now, you recall that Paul is dealing with a whole host of issues in this congregation, but at least one of them was communication. on a very large level, there was a failure to communicate as all of the members in this church sought their own interests. They failed to discern how they should have been serving one another. There was even a very specific, literal lack of communication in the way they exercised their spiritual gifts as they got up only concerned about whether or not they were receiving attention and didn't really care whether or not someone could understand what they had to say. The solution, when we get to chapter 13, was a better appreciation for and a better practice of real godly love. I think it's important that we remember that the context of chapter 13, this great text, is in dealing with the love that we are supposed to have for each other as brethren. The love that is supposed to exist within a body of Christ. And it was Paul's desire that this godly love among them would put them on the right path, would turn them in the right direction. That if they would grow to have a better understanding of what real love looked like, and if they were to have a determination to put those things into practice, then their relationships with each other would be transformed. So I want us to take just a moment to read this chapter in its entirety, but then I want us to focus especially on verse 7. We're going to make a few applications as to how some of these aspects and characteristics of love are vital to the practice of godly communication with each other. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own. It is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, think like a child, reason like a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I have also been fully known. But now, faith, hope, love, abide these three. But the greatest of these is love. Now let me say at the outset that while some of the applications I'm going to make, you may find them useful in your ability to speak to others, my primary goal this morning is to speak to those things which will help us be better listeners, to speak to those things that will help us to better understand others, to be in better contact with our brethren. I'm going to take the things in verse 7 slightly out of order. I want to begin by looking at the way in which love believes all things. I think that the first thing that we should mention is that when Paul says that love believes all things, he is not saying that love is gullible. He's not describing someone who just automatically believes every story they hear, no matter how tall it may seem. Someone who is practicing love in this way, they may be taken advantage of, but it is not because they didn't know what was going on. There is a great element here in the belief of which Paul speaks, an element of choice. When one believes all things, they are choosing to eagerly assume good in the words, the intents, and the actions of others. But in order to do so, brethren, we have to resist an awful lot of worldly conditioning. Consider that the world has done its best to teach us, to react, to be reflexive, to automatically assume the worst in the words and the actions of others. If anything can be taken in a bad light, then it should be. That is the natural assumption. If something is said towards me that I find to be offensive, then that person obviously meant to offend me. There is no room for either grace. There is no room for mercy in this worldview. Everything is seen from the perspective that others are intentionally and with great amounts of premeditation seeking my hurt and the things that they say to me. Of course, that worldview has some problems. There are some real legitimate difficulties that arise with that sort of a filter. The first problem is that it requires us to assume or to assign motives to others. We have to tell ourselves, regardless of what they said, I really know what they meant. I really know why they said it. Of course, on a basic factual level, that contradicts what Paul says earlier in the book in chapter 2 and verse 11, when he says that no one can know the thoughts of a man except for the spirit of that man. But I would suggest that there is perhaps a broader problem at work here. When I have trouble, if I have difficulty believing all things, I need to remind myself of exactly who I am working with. Who I am dealing with. These are my brethren. These people are my family. I need to process information in the light of what I know about these people to be true. Let me illustrate it like this. Let's say that on the way out this morning, as we disperse at an acceptable distance outside, James White, known troublemaker that he is, hollers over to me and says, Seth, I got a whole lot out of your lesson this morning. What sense would it make for me to then think in my mind, well, what was wrong with all of my other lessons? Did he not like those? And what was it about this lesson that he found so helpful? You know, is he saying that I've been speaking to him that way? And just on it sort of goes, as again, I really know what he meant to say by that. What sense does that make in the light of what I know about my brother to be true? And yet, as foolish as that sounds, how often when someone calls and says, you know, we missed you at services, they are so judgmental. Hey, I'm just calling to check on y'all. How's everyone doing? You know, you can't see my face, but I'm stewing right now. They're always in everyone's business. They're such a busybody. What business is theirs? How things are going on here? What do they think they are? Their brother's keeper? And on it goes to where the assumptions that I am making about the way in which people are dealing with me have no basis in the reality that I have experienced with those individuals. Again, what do I know about my brethren? When I have those interactions and someone says something, someone does something to me, can I choose to believe that it was with good intentions? Can I believe the best about other people? That transitions into what he says next in the verse, that love hopes all things. I think that in the same way we acknowledge that belief is not gullibility, that this hope of which Paul speaks is not an unreasonable hope. It's not that we simply live detached from the reality of other people. I really like the way one author put it in speaking about this verse. He says that this hope is not unreasoning optimism, which fails to take account of reality. It is rather a refusal to take failure as final. What a wonderful phrase. What a wonderful notion. A refusal to take failure as final. I love that because it acknowledges the truth that people will disappoint us. That there will be times where we let each other down and we may hurt each other. And yet by choosing to hope all things about my brethren, I do not view those failures as the final word on who that person is. Once more, we have to work against the kind of culture that the world tries to cultivate within us. The world tells us that once you have been let down by someone, you are to abandon hope. The world tells us that we should expect other people to disappoint us. And I don't mean that in, again, the realistic sense in which we leave room for others to make mistakes, but that we are actively looking for other people to fail. We want them to let us down so that our feelings can be justified. We do so to the point that we begin to read failure again into words and actions. How many conversations have ended by someone reacting like this? I knew that was what you were going to say. I knew this is how you would be. You're always like this. And most often I might say those things without ever actually having heard what the person said. It is an attitude that does not leave room for people to grow. I want you to imagine if Jesus had been this way with his disciples, if he had not hoped all things with those 12 men, can you imagine on the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17 and verse 4, Peter just blurts out, oh, it's good for us to build temples here. We'll build three of them. If Jesus just said, ah, Peter, why did I bring you here? I should have known you were going to open your mouth again. You always do this. Or if when James and John in Luke chapter 9 and verse 55 had asked whether or not they should call down from heaven the wrath of God to destroy this city of the Samaritans, and Jesus said, you do not know what kind of spirit you are of. I think about that because I believe what Jesus is saying there is this is not who you are. It is a rebuke that they ought to do better. But I think that there was a belief there that they could be better. You don't know what kind of spirit you are. You are known as the sons of thunder, but you're going to be the apostle of love. You're going to write about how if someone doesn't love their brother, they don't know God. And you're going to be a pillar in the church in Jerusalem, and you're going to help bring Jews and Gentiles together. How many times did the disciples stick their foot in their mouths and Jesus hoped all things and saw that there could be growth, that there could be progress in those men? Could you imagine if that's how God dealt with us? If God did not hope all things in his children? I have to learn to hope that my brethren can be better. That my brethren will be better. And I have to allow that to filter and guide the way in which I hear and see the things that they are doing. Otherwise, I will just set up a self-perpetuating cycle of failure. But if I compare the verses, or the terms rather, from the verse at the beginning and the end, Paul goes on to say that love bears and endures all things. The first word in this pairing, the idea of bearing all things, has to do with the idea of protection. Really of setting up a covering. And that might extend to the way in which I interact with others and that I don't, drag their failings out into the light of day. But I think that it primarily has to do with myself. That there is a covering that I put over myself, a protection over myself, so as not to take offense. Excuse me. That was in the elbow, through the mask, pointed away from all of you. Paul uses this term in chapter 9 earlier in the book in verse 12, where he speaks about a situation where he was not able to fully make use of his rights. And yet within that context, he said that he endured it, or he bared it, he covered himself up in that matter, because there were bigger things going on than him, and whether or not he was able to take full advantage of all of his rights. I think that helps to inform the way that we use this word in bearing all things. That sometimes there are things with which I am willing to put up because I know that there are bigger things happening. But the second idea, endures all things, also speaks to being able to withstand circumstance. Peter uses it in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 20 to speak of enduring unjust treatment from the world. He pairs it in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6 with the idea of learning self-control. That as we learn self-control, we are able to endure more things. Here's the main point that I want to make from these two terms. Without a doubt, sometimes someone is going to say something that will be inconsiderate to you. They may say something that seems to be inconsiderate. Sometimes brethren may say something that strikes me in the wrong way and it is hurtful. But if I am hoping all things, and if I am believing all things about my brethren, are there some things that I can simply let go? Are there some things that I can say, I can bear this? I can choose to endure this? I think once more the answer from the world is no. No, you can't. The world has drilled us in two very important areas. The first is that we are primed to be offended by everything. And the second is that it is our job to educate the offenders. Now, I'm not trying to make fun of anybody. But have you noticed how many groups and cliques that we have in our society today? And every single clique has a list of words and phrases that you need to stop saying. And so if you are a parent of an adopted child, then here is a list of things that you need to stop asking about adoption, because those things are offensive. Or if you are a single person, we need to stop preaching so much about the family because it's, you know, that's going to exclude and alienate people who are single. Or if you come from a certain part of the country, you come from a certain background, then here are things that you cannot say because they are offensive. Now, I'm not saying that we should go around using things that genuinely offend people. But the list just goes on. If you're a single parent, if you're a parent of all boys, if you're a parent of all girls, if you're a student, if you go to this college, and on the list goes, everybody is offended by something. And once more, we are primed to think that everyone should think and say exactly the right thing at all times. And those who fail in that area did so intentionally and again with great malice. Brethren, we simply need to remind ourselves of a great truth. Never assume malice when ignorance will do. Now, I don't mean that in using ignorant as an insult, you know, laughing at someone. But why would I assume that somebody was trying to hurt me when the more obvious and likely answer is they may just not have known? You know, I've only got enough room in my brain for so much information. You know what my favorite song is by my favorite band? Track 4. Because I don't know the names of any of those songs. You know my favorite player on the Alabama football team? I don't either. It's the tall guy who runs fast. I don't have room in my brain for that many details. Even the things that I take a pretty good interest in, I don't have room for all that. I imagine that a lot of you are the same way. That you've got all sorts of things going on with your family, with your workplace, with your congregation. And if you said something that was hurtful to me, or, you know, stepped on some situation that I've experienced, it was probably ignorance and not malice. Our culture reminds me a great deal of Saul in 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 7. 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 7, this is after David has slain Goliath. He has been brought in to Saul's retinue. They are on their way home. And as they come in with this sort of victory parade, there you have the young maidens singing. Saul has slain his thousands. David, his 10,000s. Can you imagine how Saul's story would have gone differently if he had simply said, yeah, well, you know, David's new stuff on the scene. He is pretty great. I'm glad he's on our side. And moved on with his day. But you know how the story goes. It says he viewed David with suspicion from that point on. They knew what they were saying. That was intentional. Well, what else is left but for them to give him the kingdom? And something so small, so slight, was a seed that grew into great bitterness, dominating him for the rest of his life. You know, look, there may be an unmistakable situation. Again, James comes up to me and he says, you're low down, you're dirty, you're no count, and you're churlish. At that point, I can't really mistake his intention. And I may have to sit down and have a conversation with the elders to restore that unity between us. But for a whole lot of other stuff, in fact, I might suggest most things. If I'm hoping and believing the best of my brethren, what is there that love will not cover? Am I willing to bear, to endure? Well, I want to challenge ourselves to a few ways to try and apply these things. And the first thing I would say is simply a repetition of what we said as we began. That this is primarily for inward reflection, for listening, not so much as talking. These ideals of bearing and hoping are not excuses for me to go around and say whatever I want and then say, well, they should have borne all things, or they should have hoped all things. Again, these are filters for me to view and hear the things that my brethren are saying and doing. And so I need to make personal application as to how I am viewing my brethren. That's going to require me to think better of my brethren. You know, I have to... Is it a confession if it was a good thing? So I deleted my Facebook account forever. It said, would you like to deactivate and you can come back in 30 days? And I said, fruitlessly, because I was talking to a computer screen, what part of forever do you not understand? And so I had to hunt down, but I found the option that says, you know, it is irretrievable, put in your password 3 times, it's so long. But unfortunately, it was just so sad to see so many people assuming the worst about their brethren. And I think it is a sad day when we hold out more hope for the people and the things of the world than we have hope for each other. Because there is so much more hope to be found in the church that was bought with Jesus' blood than in the world that is destined to perish. Now again, sometimes Christians hurt each other. Sometimes Christians say things that they ought not to say. And that needs to be dealt with, that we need to grow in those areas. But what has more hope? People who make mistakes and are striving to be better? Or people who make mistakes and they don't care. They're not accountable to anyone. They're not accountable to God. I need to think better of my brethren. I need to cultivate an attitude that looks to give grace to other people instead of one that seeks to take offense. Again, it's not a license for me to treat people the way that I want to do. This is an attitude for me. I need to be someone who extends grace as I have been shown, and not someone who seeks, what was it earlier in verse 5 of chapter 13? Love does not take into account a wrong suffered. I hope that these things are helpful to you as we seek to preserve, to build unity in this body of believers. That is what the Lord wants. It's what Paul writes of in Ephesians chapter 4, that we are to be united both in doctrine, but in mind and heart, in ideals and pursuit and walking together. And the way that we speak to each other, the way that we hear the words that are spoken to us, is core. It is essential to that unity and peace. As we draw to a close this morning, we would simply point out that the Lord doesn't just desire peace between us. He wants us to have peace with Him. And so we remind everyone that the invitation is always open. It's always extended. And if you have not yet made peace with the Lord by obeying the gospel, you have that opportunity. You can let it be made known to the brethren here, and arrangements will be made. And as always, we stand ready to pray for anyone who desires it. Now, as we close, in just a moment, we're going to be led in a prayer. I'll simply remind you of two things. After the prayer, we're going to sing a couple of songs. I'll be arranging the computer here. You'll have a few minutes. If you're not quite yet comfortable with that, then you will have an opportunity to leave. For those who are staying, we would ask that you keep your masks on for the singing. Then after the song service, we will be dismissed. We'd ask that you file out as you're dismissed by the deacons and try to keep the foyer area and the patio clear so that people are able to exit the building in a safe way. Again, it's such a blessing to be here. I look forward to singing with you in just a moment. For now, we'll go ahead and we'll be led in a word of prayer.